From the Sky News Centre at 6, Donald Trump has praised the US Senate after it allowed his nomination to sit on the highest court in the land to continue to the next stage. Members have decided by 51-49 to hold a final vote on Brett Kavanaugh. The whole process has been delayed to allow for an investigation into historical sexual misconduct allegations made against him, which he strongly denies. Protesters, like this woman, are disappointed with today's outcome.
I think everybody here just believes in democracy, the voice of the people. And I think that's why many of us have showed up. It's saying that, you know, let's truly be the voice of the people. And I just don't think that that's like really happening.
Cristiano Ronaldo's Italian club Juventus has seen its share value drop nearly 10% today. It's offered its support to the footballer who denies raping a woman in Las Vegas 9 years ago. Authorities in Indonesia are working to stop the outbreak of disease as rescuers continue to search for survivors. More than 1,500 people have died since an earthquake and tsunami a week ago. Save the Children reckons 200 young people have been left orphaned. Zubaydi Koteng from the charity says money raised will help those left behind.
Working with the government, Minister of Social Affairs and UNICEF, we set up the secretariat for handling the separated children and then organize the care of them, both the foster care and adoption.
The president of the international police agency, Interpol, has vanished. His wife has reported him missing after he travelled from France to his native country, China. Keira Knightley's admitted she was unable to leave her house for 3 months after having a mental breakdown. The actress has told The Hollywood Reporter how she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder after her sudden rise to fame. And a major revamp at Buckingham Palace is seeing more than 200 rooms being emptied in the next 6 months. The man overseeing the refit is promising to stick to budget and timings. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
BCFM Radio in partnership with Eastern Community Centre. This is Bristol. Friday, it's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, a Russian GRU in The Hague trying to undermine the investigation into Novichok. Naughty, naughty. And the Batan Kali massacre, the 24 Malay insurgency suspects by the Scots Guards way back in 1948. It's ruled out of time by the European Court of Human Rights. It's been compared to the My Lai massacre of 1968 by the Americans. But let's get Batan Kali in perspective. There were 500 My Lai villagers executed by US soldiers in Vietnam. Well, what about Mao's unspeakable Great Chinese Famine of 1958 to 1961, when around 25 million Chinese were starved to death? We hear tonight from former SAS officer Barry Wynne, who fought in Malaya, all about jungle warfare and the testimony he gave in defence of the families who lost their lives in Batan Kali as Britain was fighting a losing battle after World War II to keep its empire. Plus, Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after seven. First week, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs around 14, wet and windy tomorrow, mainly cloudy with some sunshine on Sunday. Next week, highs around 21. It's warm for October, isn't it? Sunny spells and breezy. Next weekend is the 13th and 14th of October. Highs around 18, sunny spells and breezy still. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Now, this week we've seen all sorts. My main take home from looking at what's been going on this week, Tim, is this leak, which I was chatting to you just briefly before we started, and you say you hadn't seen it, but it's on a Facebook page, which is called the Bristol Against Tower Blocks, which I think is actually a brilliant little page run by Matthew Montague Pollock. And what he's saying is that the developers' plans for Spike Island have now been leaked effectively on this website, placedynamics.com with an X on the end, and that seems to be the way things are done nowadays. So the developers decide, well, we want to completely redevelop a part of the city. This is the way we want to do it. They go to Marvin, the mayor. He approves it, and the council then goes on and gives planning permission. It doesn't really seem to be a very democratic way to decide how the city's developed, because obviously when there are big tower blocks, etc., built, this overshadows people next door. And also, it may just simply not be appropriate to build a long line of tower blocks.
Well, I guess to be fair, only certain developers get in to see Marvin, because those who come along with £150 million to build an arena for you can't get a meeting for months. So I guess it's only if you fit his agenda that you get a meeting. But yeah, I mean, there's a real issue here about how high do you go. I've always personally felt that our high buildings policy was a little overly strict, limiting, I think, at around 7 floors. But currently, it seems like no plans come forward which are not over 20 floors.
So this, sorry about the phone going off in the background there. What I'm wondering, though, is about this whole procedure for approving these sorts of developments. I thought that we had things like spatial strategies, long-term plans, where there was a democratic decision made by councillors and by residents saying, this is what we want to do in various different parts of the cities. This is where the housing developments should be. And planning permission was then granted in future years accordingly, rather than the developers just simply drawing what they want, where they want, and then getting a pat on the back.
Well, we do have spatial plans. At the moment, the regional spatial plan was actually off for the inspector, and I believe that he has ruled it inadequate at this point. And that will knock back, I think, plans for changing the a lot of the strategies that are required to bring these developments forward. So the city itself is also re-looking it at its planning documents, which of course includes its high buildings policies. And I believe it was that policy which in particular was looking at reform, in other words, completely scrapping to allow a lot more higher buildings. Now, there is an issue here. And that is, if you need to develop houses and places for people to live, I think we've got to be willing to also look at going up as well as out. Having said that, what we're seeing is a repeated developments being put forward at 20 plus stories. And that's quite a shock for the system compared to what we're used to here in Bristol.
Now, around Spike Island area, obviously, there are some tall buildings there. They're the B Bond warehouse, the big old warehouses that are there. What is being planned is pretty much everything on that area, which is around the Cumberland Basin, is going to be that, they're saying, because there's already buildings that high, that the new buildings can be that high too, all of them.
Well, I mean, I have not seen these plans, and obviously we know the mayor has talked about the Cumberland Basin development. I mean, it wasn't his idea. It's been kicking around for quite a few years, redeveloping the Cumberland Basin. And obviously, if you're redeveloping that land, it's going to be at fairly high density. But there's an important thing here is, if you go for high density development, you also need open spaces for people to go into. It's not acceptable just to build high density without the leisure space for them to go into. Otherwise, all you do is build up social problems for the future.
I'll just read out a list of some of the criticism by the Bristol Against Tower Blocks Facebook page here. It says the sheer density of the proposed buildings, the intention to build as high as the current bond warehouses, the large edifice at the tip of Spike Island, which they're talking about, no doubt giving a premium view of the suspension bridge. The view from the bridge might not be quite as premium in future. with flats and offices there. The small height of the proposed Hotwell scheme and the restoration of Avon Crescent as a through route. Some really ugly architecture. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of comments, and the lack of a replacement bridge. They're talking about taking down the big swing bridge, which I guess, I'm not even sure, that's just off the A4, isn't it? That runs down to Southfield and obviously down, ultimately down to Weston and down in the direction of Taunton direction. That massive swing bridge is going to go, apparently.
Well, Marvin has talked about removing that bridge, and what he has apparently proposed is an underground tunnel. I mean, I cannot really believe that that is the current proposal. I mean, the idea, the cost of building an underground tunnel. I mean, there's a lot of talk of building things underground. I don't think really there's been a lot of thought of the cost of that.
Well, hang on, Tim, because that's surely the obvious thing to do. When the property values are so high, you want to preserve a park maybe or something like that. That's the obvious thing to do, is send those cars underground. I mean, they do it all over the other parts of the world. Why not here?
Well, they do it in other parts of the world. I've got to be honest, I've got real concerns that these plans are not being fully thought through. This seems to be a back of the fag packet. Someone comes up with an idea, throws it out there. What I would have preferred to have seen is far more thought into exactly what's going on. And I know Mark Wright, the local ward councillor there, has been asking quite a few questions about what are the plans. He himself has doubts about a lot of the high building strategy, pointing out that actually a lot of high buildings have shown to cause great social problems not long after they've been built, and those people that live in them actually state that they're not very happy. That it's very difficult to create communities in high buildings. What you do is create isolation.
So in the Bristol Post this week, Marvin Rees hints the mayor about building tunnel under Cumberland Basin in major redevelopment plans. Could the Brunel Way road system soon become a thing of the past? It's unclear if the tunnel will be open to pedestrians, cars, or cyclists, or restricted to set groups after the Labour mayor revealed plans to redevelop the area, which he wants to name Western Harbour, in the State of the City address last year. Details about the project are sparse, but he has been seeking private investment for the scheme in China and during an international conference in Cannes in France. Speaking at the Bristol Arena's call-in session on September the 20th, Marvin said, while we were in Kuala Lumpur, we met with four or five developers. Top of the list of things we were talking about was redevelopment of the Cumberland Basin, Western Harbour, and the opportunity to knock down that swing bridge, move it and build a tunnel and put 3,005 units down. 3,500 units, that is to say, places to live for you and I, down there. Now, I mean, the thing is, this does seem to me to be something which is a corporate-led thing. Now, the trouble is, Tim, it's very difficult for the City Council to be saying, we are going to decide where the houses get built, when actually you're not going to be paying for them.
Well, I can tell you that 3,500 units won't pay for a tunnel under the Cumberland Basin.
Martin, what do you make of this? We're really looking, I suppose, at the future of the city, and particularly everyone is craving more places to live. We desperately need more places to live, if only to sort of bring down the price of renting properties, that sort of thing, or even buying, to try and satisfy the demand for housing. Is this the corporate world that's making these decisions about where places are going to be built, or is it is there some sort of democratic process involved here?
Well, the planning system in Britain is skewed in favour of the developers. Don't forget that the council can block developments, but developers can then appeal to central government, and they frequently get overruled local councils. So I've had some dealings with the planning department when I used to work for the council, and therefore there's a problem that if you object to something, they will then be able to appeal it, and councils can't appeal if things go against them. So the whole basis of British planning law is that unless something is illegal, then they're allowed to do it. And the idea that somehow local councils and central government plan things, maybe they ought to, but in actual fact they don't. We've got a laissez-faire approach in this country. And so, for example, when my parents live in Herefordshire, there's a development of soft fruit farms, and it's caused quite a lot of inconvenience as lorries going down little lanes and so on, and people complain about it. But my dad, who was a Liberal Democrat councillor in the area, he said, well, there's no way we can stop these people as long as they're not breaking the law, and they can show that they're not breaking the law, and they're performing, you know, then things go ahead. And that's the sort of entrepreneurial idea. But what strikes me about this, these flats aren't going to be for poor people or even moderately well-off people. They're going to be luxury. They're going to be luxury shoeboxes, aren't they?
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do.
For people who don't live in Bristol,
I'll put a link up on our show page.
They've got the money
at thisweek.org.uk. I'll put a link up to the Facebook group Matthew Montagu Pollock set up, and also put a link to this project page, the Cumberland Basin project page at Place Dynamics, DYNAMIX. So you can see what is being planned there, particularly for local residents. I mean, I don't know if they're even being told about this. It just seems to me this is development being parachuted in from above. But there is a positive side to all of this, and that is because Bristol's own targets, the City Council's own targets for housing, are doing quite well, Tim. This headline in the Bristol Post this week: City is set to smash Marvin Rees's target of 2,000 new homes a year. The housing crisis, says the Post, is being tackled head on. And that's Jack Pitts, the local Democracy reporter, writing this. Bristol's building even more homes than the city mayor Marvin Rees promised in his manifesto. Some raised eyebrows when the prospective leader of Bristol said before the 2016 election builders would be putting up 2,000 homes, 800 of them affordable each year. Well, affordable. They really should put inverted commas on that.
Yeah, I think we should also note at the moment the target is well short on the affordable. In fact, the percentage of affordable homes coming through has slipped, not increased.
The time he said 2,000 homes were needed to fix Bristol's housing crisis. 20 years ago, a home in Bristol would cost the average buyer 3.5 times their annual salary. Today, it costs the same person, Martin, 9 times their yearly wage. So that's really, in real terms, has gone up 3 times the cost of housing.
Well, I mean, the housing market, if so-called, in this country is broke. Even Sajid Javid said this. Even some of the Tories are waking up to it, because we've had 30 years of rubbish policy, and that includes 13 years of Labour government where they weren't prepared to tackle the vested interests in the industry. And eventually, after 30 years, you end up with the crisis we've got, with a housing bubble that will burst and drag the economy down with it, and that's coming soon, folks.
So is the council broke, Tim?
The council's not broke. The council currently has about £150 million in the bank. So it's far from broke. But of course, the council every year does have increasing demands on its revenue budget. I mean, it is a difficult time for local government. National government do not provide enough to local government to meet the demands that are placed on it. With an ageing population, with increasing complications for those people to remain living in their homes, which is what everybody wants, that it increases costs on local councils every year. And this is a real issue for all local councils, of how do we make sure each year we've got enough revenue to meet demand.
It's like even the Queen is being made homeless. She's been told today, you're going to have to move out of Buckingham Palace because there's going to be a refit. And she said, well, where do you want me to go? So, perhaps she's got a few spare palaces, Martin.
I think probably she has. And she's getting a refit. Is she paying for the refit, or are we paying for it?
Well, good question. And it's a good question.
Presumably we are, otherwise she wouldn't be moaning about it.
The palace is undergoing a £369 million a resurfacing programme to replace ageing and dangerous electrical wiring and boilers. It started in April. The Queen's boilers, I'm afraid, do need overhaul. It's going to be completed in 2027. So I think this is something that she is paying for. It certainly looks like it.
Hardly complain about a refit that she's ordered herself, Tony, can she?
No. And also, she's got a few spare palaces, I'm quite certain. But when it comes to revenue, one of the things on the horizon, Tim, is this potential congestion charge here in the city. Are you for or against that?
I've always opposed a congestion charge, and I'll be clear why. I mean, the community I represent and where I live out at have very, very poor poor public transport. I would say over the last 12 years we've lost around 40% of our public transport. So when it comes to congestion charge, and it's been put forward that it's to pay for an underground system, one that we will have no access to because no one ever intends to build an underground out to Hengrove and Whitchurch, I think quite rightly we say, not on our watch. The other issue I have with the congestion charge is, of course, the rich can continue to drive into town and will pay it. It is those on fixed incomes and lower incomes who will be hit hard, and often because of the jobs they do not have good public transport options. I've always been in favour though of a workplace parking levy. In fact, when I was a transport cabinet member, I tried to bring one forward, but the business lobby completely opposed it. And my issue here was, of course, the vast majority of people who had the free parking spaces in the city centre were the directors, not their cleaners.
As someone who's done that job of transport, what do you make of Metrobus and the way it's all rolled out, Tim? I mean, did it ever reach any of the expectations you had?
Well, I think it's far short of what was envisaged. Given the amount of public money that's gone in, to have about half the network that we've paid for, which is what we've got with regards to the actual bus network, is a great shame. And it appears that what's happened is, in the last year or two, those in charge have decided to walk away, wash their hands of any responsibility, and just say to the bus networks, run what you want. That is not what was envisaged or planned. It was supposed to be a planned network, and in particular my part of the city was promised three routes. We currently have zero routes. We are being told one will turn up sometime next year.
I mean, Metrobus was never going to be in any way going to make that much of a difference, was it? I mean, this is just basically a bus with a couple of silly wheels on the side of it that's made to look as if it's something special when it isn't. It's not a tram. I mean, I've just a couple of weeks ago spent a while in Holland and spent the whole day on public transport over there. It's just so incredibly easy to get around. The trains, the trams, trolley buses everywhere, coming regularly, costing very little, and what happens is people just leave the cars at home.
I mean, that's true, but a tram, a single tram would be no better, because again, it's just one route. What you need is a whole infrastructure, and that is
but
the problem.
But don't you look at where the main route, where the main commuter routes are, and you stick a tram into the city centre and out the other side?
Well, yes, but when you look at what happened with Edinburgh, everybody sort of has nightmares. I mean, it took years to deliver. It was hundreds of millions of pounds over budget. The big problem is, without very much planning, we've put all our services under the roads, and our requirements regarding trams are that all the services need to be dug up. Now, the requirements we have in this country are slightly different to the requirements in Europe, which is why they can often deliver these projects far easier than we can. I mean, there's an issue that we need to look at on how our regulation around these projects if we want to deliver them. I actually don't necessarily think we have to go down the tram route. I would love to see trams, but I'm also a realist and realise we're unlikely to get the £1 billion to deliver a proper tram network. We can actually do it through bus a great deal and enhancing our train. But I think what we need is a bus system that works for the people of Bristol, not one that works for lining the profits of a private company.
So what would you actually do? System. What would you actually do then? Because what would you bring it in-house and run it?
I would use
the
legal
council?
Powers that the Metro Mayor currently has. He has the power to bring forward a franchising system. He has the power to publicly plan the bus network, the routes, the price, and put that out for competition to the bus companies. He's been sitting on this now for what, a year and a half without doing anything? It's time he got on and actually created a proper bus network system through the franchising powers he's been given by government.
I'm a bit cynical, Martin Summers, and I think that potentially the reason for the lack of effectiveness of our public transport here in Bristol is partly to give a good excuse to bring in this congestion charge.
Well, I think that's too conspiratorial. It's more of a cock-up than that, isn't it? It's just a mess. There's no real desire to bring a congestion charge in. And what would, the same as we were just talking about housing a minute ago, the fact that we've not had an integrated transport policy either locally or nationally for decades. I mean, the privatisation of the coach industry was stupid. And they had 13 years of Labour government and they didn't do anything about it. Only in London have you got some integrated transport strategy, because they couldn't privatise it directly. They had to be realistic. But if, as I said before, if you carry on doing stupid stuff for decades, you end up in a cul-de-sac, don't you?
Okay, another local story. I think probably the last one this week for the time being, which is a headline that just left my head in a spin, which is Airbus in the Bristol Post. Airbus Filton takes on swathes of apprentices amid growing fears of Brexit carnage. Now, Tim, why would Airbus take on a whole load of people when they think they might have to shut down?
Well, any good business is planning for the future, and in which case you should be training your apprentices. But let us not think that Brexit is not a major threat to this country. It is, and every day that goes by, it increasingly looks like we may crash out of the European Union with no deal, and that will be devastating for certain industries. And one of the ones it will be most devastating for will be Airbus, especially as to make the planes they make. The parts have to cross multiple borders. Each time they cross a border between the European Union and Britain, it will then potentially face a massive tax. And that will destroy their industry if this is not resolved soon. And I mean, we now have a matter of days to resolve this.
Wasn't the writing on the wall for Airbus when they closed the airport at Filton? I mean, surely, you know, you can't run something which is part of a major international aircraft manufacturing business if you're running it from just any old industrial estate. You need to be able to fly things in and out and fly people in and out.
They claim they don't. I got to be honest, I agree with you. I think a lot of us were very suspicious when that was brought forward. Obviously, I can understand the land value of and they could get a lot of money out of selling that land for housing. But you do then think, what is the long-term strategy for Airbus? I mean, obviously, that is completely separate to Brexit, whether or not, you know, they're committed to this region and carrying on. I hope they are. And of course, it is also about the services and industries that surround them. There are dozens of companies that surround them that feed into that business. And it is difficult for them to replicate that in another city. So it's not as simple. It's not just the physical infrastructure. It is that support network and knowledge network as well, which is around Airbus. And that's one thing which does keep it grounded here in our city. But with Brexit, there will be a real, real threat. I mean, we will have to fight really hard to make sure we keep Airbus here.
Martin, many of the industries up at Filton used to be nationalised, part of British British Aerospace. Yeah, so wasn't that where the decision was made? Once that's privatised, surely the decisions, if they're being made outside the UK, we can't expect people in Toulouse or whatever to make decisions which benefit people who are trying to get jobs here in Bristol.
Well, if you think back to the actual airfield itself, if you remember, we had the grandson of Sir George White on this show some years ago, and he was furious because his grandfather had basically gifted Filton Airfield to the city as an airfield and to be used for that purpose. But of course, when British Aerospace was nationalised at the end of the war, that then became part of British Aerospace. And then when it was privatised by the Tories, they then can...
It was originally the Bristol Aircraft Company.
Well, exactly, but they can then sell it off. As you know, they then sell it off for you know, basically as property development. But of course, the original, it's a bit like the Trustee Savings Bank, which was also privatised in the 1980s, was set up originally as something independent of government, was taken over by government, and then when it was privatised, you're basically selling something that you don't actually own.
So British Aerospace were just asset stripping. They saw the airfield as an asset to sell off.
Yeah, well, that's the writing on the wall for whether an aerospace, because the real competition is between aerospace in Europe and aerospace in the US. And the US, of course, simulates their aerospace industry by their massive military expenditure. They don't have a plan, they just have loads and loads of money to spend, taxpayers' money, on military aircraft, which then spills over to subsidise their civilian aircraft production. And of course, you can't compete with that on a national level, which is why Airbus and versus Boeing is what we're talking about. And a lot of these sanctions on Russia, I was reading the other day, have been directed at their aerospace industry, which is a potential competitor, a third competitor. And this comes back to big questions about what's the appropriate scale of production for certain kinds of industries. It isn't like selling tomatoes. If you're going to produce aircraft, you need big companies.
Tim,
big companies implies low competition.
Tim, can the market deliver jobs in this sort of situation? Surely the government's going to have to you know, maybe after Brexit, start intervening far more and saying, well, actually, we're going to have an industry here and stop building all these houses, that sort of thing, to make sure that there are jobs. Without jobs, the country's going down the tubes, isn't it?
Well, this is a worry of a lot of us, that the current mayor's policy of just building housing but without necessarily worrying about planning for industry and work is creating a problem in the future. We may not see it for 10 or 20 years, but we've seen it in the past where we've built large estates out on the fringes of the city, but the jobs have been in the north or in Avonmouth. It's been very difficult for people in South Bristol to get to them. I mean, at the moment, there are around 3,000 houses planned to be built in my ward by the mayor. There's virtually no business or industry or office space involved with those plans. In fact, offices are being stripped out to help deliver the extra housing. So there'll be less space for jobs, but far more housing. Now, that means those people will have to move to get to jobs. And of course, that means the transport situation will get worse, not better. So it does seem like there's been a real breakdown in thinking here, because at one point we were pushing very hard as a city that we'd deliver more jobs in South Bristol. I mean, regarding the aerospace's future, I mean, you're right, it is a worldwide market, and that's one reason why us coming out of the European Union is completely insane, because that gave us that oomph to fight on a worldwide market, and it meant that we had big industries that could build the aircraft and they could stand up to the Americans and others who work in that
but
market.
But surely, I mean, we didn't, did we? Not here in Britain, because these big conglomerates like EADS and Airbus aren't controlled from Britain anymore, so these big companies weren't necessarily working in a British interest.
Well, these big companies now are European. They are a mixture. Who owns them is a mixture. Who runs them is a mixture. Quite often, actually, when you look at the management of them, there are a lot of British people there on the boards of these companies.
There's a lot of Germans.
And there's a lot of Germans as well. And that was the point. Countries are working together for added benefit. And of course, when we come crashing out, do we really believe that we will have an aerospace industry that survives against, say, an aerospace industry of the European Union?
Well, that's a good question.
There is no chance.
Yeah. Another story, national story this time. I think really important, actually, from a civil liberties point of view. This is in The Independent, Alex Matthew King writing, fracking protesters, absurdly harsh jail sentences spark calls for judicial review backed by hundreds of scientists. Environmental protesters are the first to receive prison terms since 1932. The Peak District mass trespass, which established the right to roam, say solicitors. More than 200 academics have signed a letter calling for a judicial review of absurdly harsh prison sentences handing out to three fracking protesters this week. An open letter started by staff at the University of Sussex, those hippies down at Sussex University, says that the jail terms of between 15 and 16 months for halting a convoy of lorries carrying shale drilling equipment set a dangerous precedent. The heroes, I would call them, are Simon Roscoe Blevins, 26 years old, Richard Roberts, 36, and Rich Loazu, 31, are thought to be the first environmental protesters to receive a jail sentence in the UK since 1932. So this is a peaceful protest, Martin Summers, just stopping the vehicles going down the street, and they've been jailed. You know, this is actually quite a long time, isn't it? Between 15 and 16 months.
Well, it sets a precedent, doesn't it? And it's a very poor precedent. I mean, in the past, people who've carried out peaceful protests like this, like Greenpeace or whatever, they expect to be fined and so on. But, I mean, looking at it from the other point of view...
Just a minute. Quite often, they are just simply arrested and then released.
Well, that's how it used to be. But, of course, if you're against fracking, these people are now political prisoners. And they're political prisoners whichever way you look at it. And if you're in the anti-fracking movement, should get behind them and use their prison terms as a stick to beat the government with.
So, Tim, is a year and a half in jail the right amount for standing in front of a lorry?
I don't know the details of the case, but working on the presumption that they were non-violent and did not hurt anybody, it sounds utterly ridiculous to send somebody to prison for a protest that did not result in anyone being hurt. But I do not know the details of the case, but I cannot believe that most right-minded people would think that was, one, a good use of prison resources, and two, the sort of democracy that we would want to live in.
I'll just give you the words of the judge. Robert Altham, A-L-T-H-A-M. He said the defendants caused costs and disruption to Quadrilla, but their other victims were the many members of the public and businesses who were affected by the traffic.
Well, that's the price of democracy. We've always had a tradition in this country, as long as people were non-violent, that their protests would not be criminalised beyond the fact that they're, you know, we recognise that people are breaking the law here, but they're not being violent. And as long as they're not being, I mean, don't forget there's all these arguments about picket lines, people throwing bricks at lorries and trying to block the, you know, block the road violently and so on. And of course, that's then creates issues. I mean, during the miners' strike, several pickets were killed by lorries, for example.
What these people are doing, I mean, I'll just give you their jobs. They are, one of them is a soil scientist, another is a teacher, and the other is a piano restorer. They are actually backed 100%, well, not quite 100%, 85% by the public. 85% of the public don't support fracking, 16%, Tim, do.
Well, I agree with them. I changed my mind on fracking a few years ago and now strongly oppose it.
Why?
I'll tell you why. I at one point was willing to accept there may be an argument that we needed to have an energy bridge, but when I saw the government completely abandon investment in renewable energy, I felt any sort of form of pass I was willing to give them on a short-term fracking went out the window. And for me now, fracking is just not an option. Actually, renewables have proven to be a very efficient way for us to get our energy, and we should be putting far more investment into renewable energy. But to go back to the issue of these protesters, I mean, it is an affront to democracy. It is an affront to our rights of every citizen if they have been put in jail for a non-violent protest. And I do hope that that they will appeal that sentence. And I do actually think the Attorney General should look at that sentence. They have the powers to actually take it back to court. Normally, it's the other way around, where a sentence they consider to be too light. But I think actually the government themselves should be looking to step in here, because it reflects badly on the government, even though this has been done by a judge.
On this topic of renewables, there's also a power station, a nuclear power station planned at Hinkley C. And this week, scientists are saying that there's potentially radioactive mud which is being dug up to build that nuclear power station and then shipped across the Bristol Channel and dumped next to Cardiff. So there's a story in The Guardian this week. Welsh leaders are urged to halt nuclear mud dumping off Cardiff, in inverted commas, nuclear mud. Sediment from Hinkley Point C construction site is being disposed of at Cardiff grounds. Pressure's increasing on the Labour-led Welsh government to halt the dumping of nuclear mud in the sea close to Cardiff after a campaign by a group of scientists. A motion calling on the government to suspend the licence allowing mud excavated and disposed of just off the near the Welsh capital, but to be debated next week. Now, there is a theory amongst some of these scientists, Tim, that the reason that the government has stopped supporting renewable energy is to make sure that the nuclear has a future, because financially, as we keep hearing, it's far, far too expensive, not just to generate the power, but also to look after the waste in tens of thousands of years into the future. So what's your thoughts about this sort of general thing of government energy policy with renewables and nuclear particularly in mind?
Well, I think nuclear is a financial disaster. I think it makes no financial sense at all. When you look at, I'll say, the total cost of nuclear, you can't look at just the buy point, which is a massive inflation on current electricity prices, the buy point they've got as a guarantee price for the electricity for that power station when it opens. You've also got to look at what are the ongoing costs of nuclear. I mean, it takes decades to close these power stations down. They have to be intoned, and then of course you've got the issue of the potential issue of maybe some nuclear radiation that's got into the environment, which is the debate here. I have no idea if there is that issue with the mud or not. My actual biggest issue with nuclear really is that it's a bad financial deal for our country. We should not really be going down the nuclear route. We should be going down the renewables route. The renewables have shown that they give us a good return. The price of renewables is constantly going down. It is now virtually at a point where it does not even need a subsidy. The government should be looking to push far more into renewables. And of course, being an island, we've got great capacity of having 24-hour renewable electricity.
Emeritus Professor Keith Barnum at Imperial College would agree with you to a large extent. I mean, he's basically saying that the... Although I'll just explain what this whole business of the nuclear radioactive mud. Is it really radioactive? Well, he says, yes, it is. What EDF, who are building this power station, have done is they've tested this mud, they say. They've tested it, but they've tested it for gamma radiation. Well, he's pointing out, actually, the most likely types of radiation are in there. It's not gamma at all. It's alpha radiation from plutonium. So you've been testing it in totally the wrong way, in the knowledge that you're not actually looking for the type of radiation which is most likely to be there. Martin, we've also heard, I mean, Keith has also pointed out in this Guardian article that a tidal lagoon down at Bridgewater would generate roughly the same amount of power, not on a constant stream, but obviously through the cycles of the tides, as Hinkley Power Station for a fraction of the cost.
Well, I agree with Tim that we shouldn't be doing nuclear power for the reasons he's put forward, and also we should.
So why are we? Come on,
there's vested interests. EDF, basically the French are addicted to nuclear power because they've spent so much money on it over the years. And once you're addicted to something, you've got to sell it on to other people if you're going to defray the cost to yourself. It's only state run, and it's the Chinese and the French who push nuclear power, both of which is run by the state. It's not actually a private industry. And of course the real issue to my mind is not just renewables. We need to be much more energy efficient. Amory Lovins pointed this out years ago from the Rocky Mountain Institute. The real issue is to actually reduce your energy use, not generate more energy.
Okay, Tim, why are we still going for nuclear?
Well, I think the government at the time was convinced that there was going to be an energy gap and were pushed down a route they should not have gone. I think also, let us remember, I think when this plant was agreed to, it was the coalition years. So you had the Liberal Democrats in the government trying to push the renewable side, and you had the Conservatives pushing the nuclear. And I suspect what we're left with now is a result of a dumb compromise.
Well, I love Keith Barham because he's put a different point of view, which I find potentially this is the real reason, is because you have enormous nuclear industries in China and in France who are desperate to build power stations, and they can't anymore in their own countries. The Chinese government have stopped building nuclear power stations. They say we've got too many already, and the same in France. And so you've got a massive industry that's going around the world looking for some muggins to build one of these power stations. Anyway, he's a bit of a star, I think, Professor Keith Barnum. I'll put a link up to that article, theguardian.com, and the headline was "Activists Call for a Halt to Nuclear Mud Dumping Off Wales." Journalist is Stephen Morris at The Guardian. Now, look, other things have been going on this week. We've got something called the Tory Party Conference. We better get to that. We've only got a quarter of an hour or so left. And let's start with the wonderful Esther McVeigh. I mean, I was thinking we ought to listen to Philip Hammond, but I'm afraid he sends me to sleep, Philip Hammond. So let's have a listen to Esther McVeigh, because, you know, tens of millions of people across this country rely on these DWP payments. So let's see what she's got to say for herself, the Work and Pensions Secretary, Esther McVeigh, at the Tory conference this week.
Let's not forget, under Labour, the number of households where no one had ever worked almost doubled. In stark contrast, since 2010, we have added on average 1,000 more jobs each and every day. And despite what Labour says, the vast majority of these are full-time permanent roles. We have created more jobs, more new jobs in the UK since 2010 than France, Spain, Ireland, Netherlands, Austria, Sweden, and Norway combined. Youth unemployment has plummeted by almost 50%, whereas in Spain and Italy, it is almost three times higher. making us the envy of Europe. However, it's about more than numbers. We are helping people take control of their lives, and we are transforming the country into a great working nation, prepared for a prosperous post-Brexit future. And it is the Conservatives who have redesigned the welfare system to make it fit for the 21st century, the vision of Ian Duncan Smith.
Well, the Conservatives are obsessed with welfare benefits and trying to pick on the poor. It was a shame they're not so obsessed with trying to get the big corporations to pay the tax they all owe us.
Yeah, but I mean, you as the Lib Dems were in coalition with this austerity programme first started in 2010. You signed up to it, Tim.
We were in coalition with the Conservatives, and we had to spend 5 years trying to stop them from bringing in some of their crazy plans. And obviously, at the end of the day, we have to take some responsibility for some of the decisions that came through, and some I've never agreed with, such as the bedroom tax. I always said, argued that was a stupid idea that would save no money, and it saved no money and caused a lot of distress. But at the same time, we now see the Conservatives unleashed. They are going full for leather after those people who can afford it least. And it is true, we have a lot more jobs in this country. That is good, but they are often low paid, and they are sometimes in the wrong places. This is what the Conservatives don't talk about. We've got whole regions of this country where it is nearly impossible to get a job.
Okay, but before we hear from Martin, let's hear a bit more from Esther McVeigh, where this time she's talking about state pensions and the great success of her department, Department for Work and Pensions.
We are providing certainty in retirement through the state pension, which has increased by £1,450 per pensioner since 2010, in sharp contrast to the 75p increase pensioners received under Labour in 2000. Remember that? And we will continue to protect UK pensioners living in the EU post-Brexit by applying the triple lock to those as we do here. At the same time, we are delivering a private pensions revolution. More people than ever are saving into a workplace pension, up nearly 50% in the last 6 years, and significantly driven by younger people. Through automatic enrolment, we have helped create almost 10 million new pension savers. And we will be giving people the opportunity to access their pension information through an industry-led pension dashboard, building on the government's Check Your State Pension online service. We are opening up opportunities for all through our welfare, employment and pension reforms. Only the Conservative government have a track record of success in these critical areas. We are here to give a hand up and not a hand out. We are the party of opportunity and social mobility. These values unite us all. They will also be the guiding light for our exciting post-Brexit future with a Conservative government, a UK which is working like never before and open to business, an inclusive nation with opportunities for all. Thank you.
Well, I think she was saying about the enrolment. I've just picked up on the pensions issue, automatic enrolment. What's happened around the rest of the world where people have been forced to go into private pension schemes is, you know what happens? They go bust. So you've been forced, your money has been taken off you without your consent, put in a private pension scheme, and then you don't get anything for the end of it. That's what happened to all the people I knew in Poland. They had to transfer their state pensions to private providers. They had no idea who they were. It was half their salaries. And then, in fact, it turned out they got nothing for that, nothing at all.
Well, I think the automatic enrolment was more about people who were in the private sector who didn't have pensions. And I do agree that being able to ensure that everybody is saving for a pension is a good thing. People switching this their pensions paid into state sector into the private sector is absolutely mad, and I know there's been an industry trying to get people to do that, and they should resist that at any point. I did want to just point out, though, every positive thing she pointed out there is Conservative Party policy. Well, actually, the Liberal Democrat policy brought in the 2010 coalition government, which the Conservatives opposed in the 2010 general election, and we forced it through. So it is quite ironic that she was taking credit for the triple lock, which actually the Conservatives stood on a manifesto opposing in 2010, and we forced it into law.
Well, when Bristol Tory Jeff Gollop was here a few weeks ago, he said he's definitely not going to bother going to the Conservative Party conference, mainly because they just talk at you. There's no motions, no votes, no debates. I suppose you'd also say no votes for the leader either, Martin, because it was Andrea Leadsom, wasn't it, that just fell on her sword. Theresa May was, nobody elected her.
Well, I mean, the travails of the Conservative Party are one thing. I think just coming back to the overall economic situation, we've had quantitative easing and virtually zero interest rates for nearly a decade. And on the back of that, people think that they've got a full employment economy, which, of course, they haven't. There's still nearly a million people unemployed, which would have been unthinkable from 1945 to 1973. And you've got to think in these long terms. And when the housing market crashes on the other side of Brexit, this is all going to disappear like snow in summer.
What do you make of the lack of discussion, lack of democracy? Do you have a similar thing at your conference, Tim?
Oh, the Liberal Democrat conference is very different. Policy is made at Liberal Democrat conference. Members and local parties put forward motions. Those motions are debated. If your motion doesn't make it, you can push it through as an emergency motion. And nearly every year there is a motion on the order paper which the leadership did not want to see, and inevitably conference will vote it through just as a thank you to the leadership.
And have a look at a conference. You haven't got far to go this weekend.
That's right. If people really want to go and look at a conference, the Green Party are in town.
Are they asking for people to go along and see them, watch them? Can you just go wander in? Do you know? Well, they are. They're in Bristol in the council house, aren't they, this weekend?
Well, I presume they've got some sort of security. Well, most places have these days.
We'll cover that next week anyhow. But so let's go on to Theresa May's speech now, where she talks about the end of austerity, which I'm going to question right now, because after we hear from Theresa May, we're going to hear from John Pilger, the Australian journalist, about what he thinks. And he was on the Russia Today this week talking about austerity. So we'll hear, though, from the Prime Minister, Theresa May.
British people need to know that the end is in sight. And our message to them must be this: we get it. We're not just a party to clean up a mess. We're a party to steer a course to a better future. Sound finances are essential, but they're not the limit of our ambition. Because you made sacrifices, there are better days ahead. So when we've secured a good Brexit deal for Britain, at the spending review next year, we will set out our approach for the future. Debt as a share of the economy will continue to go down. Support for public services will go up. Because a decade after the financial crash, people need to know that the austerity it led to is over and that their hard work has paid off.
Well, a big round of applause there. Has people's hard work paid off, Tim Kemp from the Lib Dems here in Bristol?
Well, clearly not if we go ahead with Brexit. I mean, the reality is that's going to cost us around £100 billion. So here's an idea. Let's not leave, and we put the £100 billion back into public services.
So
instead.
You're not a Democrat, then? You don't believe that if the people vote for something that you think we should do the opposite?
Well, I'm a Democrat. We did vote for something, actually, in 1975, but no one seemed to care about that. So we've had another referendum where people cheated, people lied, people have been convicted.
On both sides?
People have been convicted for fraud on one side. One side, people were convicted for fraudulently overspending and stealing the result. And I think what we need to do now is we need to put back the final deal and say, as you didn't actually know what you were voting for, because you were told something different every single day, this is what it is. You can vote for it now, and that's fine. It'll be debate over then. we will leave.
Well, we're told something different every day in a general election too. So do we overturn that? And we
Do. We overturn it every 5 years when you get to vote for a new government. But apparently, those people who support Brexit say no, that one is forever. Suddenly, we have a vote where you can never get to change your mind again. That's not democracy. Democracy is people have a right to change their mind. And what we should do now, we're getting to see the truth of this Brexit. There's an absolute financial disaster for our country. We should be willing to give people the final say on this. Because it's very clear we don't want our politicians to have a final say, because they're a complete bunch of idiots.
50 years' time, do you think we should have another vote then? I mean, it was 50 years since the previous one, wasn't it?
I don't mind. If in 50 years' time people want another vote, they can have another vote. My point is, now we know the truth. Now we know that, in fact, one side did not follow the rules. We should be willing to give people the final say.
Now, let's go straight to John Pilger.
If you remember the way the great crash in Wall Street and in the City of London elsewhere was reported, it was reported as the crooked banks. It was quite astonishing. Right across the British press, you would see pictures of the banks and of we name the guilty bankers, and people will be hauled out and they'd be shamed in public, as usually lesser beings are shamed. So that lasted, I calculated, for just under a year, about 9 months. And then it changed. It wasn't the debt, the crooked banks. Alistair Darling, Gordon Brown's Chancellor, forked out £500 billion, effectively gave it to the banks. I'm sorry if I'm a few billion out there, but it was an epic amount of the country's treasure. And that was good. The approved news was that was good. But the crooked banks and the crooked bankers then disappeared from the media. Instead, a word that was just lying in the dictionary, being used from time to time during the Second World War, austerity, was hauled out, and we now have something called austerity. And austerity means that all the civilized premises of life in this country have to be attacked, have to be undermined. The hospitals have to be starved of funds. Poor people have to remain poor people and then get poorer. Everything has to be cut back. Councils have to lose something like up to 40% of the money they have available to do normal things for people. That is their responsibility. That went overnight. The debt became our debt. It became people's debt. The whole notion of crooked banks went completely. I've never known a reversal from fact to illusion so completely. And it was accepted. It was accepted by all sides. It was accepted by both sides in Parliament. It was accepted by all media. It would be, yes, but even those that had named the guilty bankers with such enthusiasm no longer named them. Austerity had to be solved. The debt had to be paid back above all. It was a complete con. It was an ideological situation. The National Health Service could have been paid several times over by the money that fled this country, hemorrhaged from this country, allowed by the tax regime.
Now, let's go straight to Boris Johnson, who got the biggest audience of the Conservative Party conference, and he certainly seems to be trying to groom himself, as he has been for many years, as the Tory leader in waiting.
It was such a mistake of us to, or is such a mistake of us, to leave on the Chequers terms, locked in the tractor beam of Brussels. We will not only be prevented... We will not only be prevented by the Chequers deal from offering our tariff schedules, we will be unable to make our own laws, to vary our regulatory framework for goods, agri-foods, and much more besides. And that is politically humiliating for a £2 trillion economy. And it occurs to me that the authors of Chequers risk prosecution under the 14th century statute of praemunire, which says that no foreign court or government shall have jurisdiction in this country. It would mean... Look it up. Look it up. I thought you'd like that point. It would mean that UK business and industry, the entire economy, would be exposed perpetually to regulations that might have been expressly designed at the behest of foreign competitors to do them down. It would mean that whatever the EU came up with in future, banning the sale of eggs by the dozen, banning diabetics from driving, banning vaping, whatever, and all those have been at least considered by Brussels in the last few years, all this nonsense we would have to implement with no ability to change or resist. That is not pragmatic. That is not a compromise. It is dangerous and unstable, politically and economically. My fellow Conservatives, this is not democracy. That is not what we voted for.
Well, you've certainly got one of the biggest audiences of the Tory conference, Tim. Next Prime Minister?
Well, I hope not. I mean, Boris Johnson might think he's a good speaker, but personally, I wouldn't even trust him to read Jack O'Nory, let alone be the Prime Minister of this country.
What about Chequers? Do you think that's a flyer or not? That's what he's criticising there, isn't it?
I mean, the only thing he's right is Chequers is dead. Chequers was dead the second it was written because it breached the EU's founding principles. They've been very, very clear what their four principles were, and every time we seem to try to go back to them and say, no, we want you to change them.
So he and David Davis were right to resign at the time, were they?
Well, they were right or wrong to resign. I don't know. I just don't really understand why they sat there all day and clearly didn't point out that what was coming out was going to be unacceptable to the EU.
So what?
We are now 2 years. 2 years past the vote, and they've got no plan.
Why is Theresa May pursuing something which was never going to work right from the start then?
Desperation.
Martin?
I think I agree with that. They've snookered themselves completely. And of course, their failure is going to be the country's failure if we crash out without a deal. And everybody will suddenly realise what a mess we really are in.
At that point, surely, Theresa May will be out and Boris Johnson in.
Or Jeremy Corbyn, even, Tony.
Well, why would there be a...
Because the DUP won't support the backstop, and they're going to pull the government down.
OK, fascinating. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 now, thanks to our guest Lib Dem Councillor Hengrove and Whitchurch Park. Tim Kent joins us after the news as we look at the global picture and hear from John Pilger.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.